fourth speaker is Dr. Phyllis Herder, late 18th and early 19th century Tongan arts and their legacies. Phyllis Herder's work has always been across the traditional disciplines of anthropology, Pacific history, and women's gender studies. She began working in Polynesia in the early 1980s and continues to research, publish, and teach on Tongan ethnography. European explorers in Polynesia, Polynesia art and material culture, Tongan oral tradition and history, gender, disease, and colonialism, as well as Polynesian textiles, traditional and contemporary. She is currently leading a research team on a project funded by the Marsden Fund, Royal Society of New Zealand, Ancient Futures, Late 18th and 19th Century Tongan Arts, Their Legacies on Art and Material Culture from Tonga in the Late 18th and the 19th Centuries. She is also working on two European expeditions, excuse my pronunciation, Meles Pina and Brunei?
Don Tracasto,
wonderful. which reached Tonga in 1793. She also continues to work on quilting in Polynesia. She holds degrees from the University of Arizona, BA Anthropology, the University of Auckland, MA First Class Anthropology, and Australian National University PhD Pacific Studies, Pacific History, and has taught Pacific History at Victoria University, Wellington, and Women's Studies and Anthropology at the University of Auckland.
I'm going to finish up, hopefully not with too much taking too much time, talking about the context, influence, and ambitions of the Europeans who came and did collecting in the Pacific, collecting items like the top cloth that have made up the book that we're going to have a good look at. I hope we're still going to have time. Europeans entered the Pacific in the late 18th and early 19th century on really august expeditions. They were quite different from the voyages that went beforehand, and Europeans had been coming to the Pacific for a very long time. But what changed in the late 18th and right through to the early 19th century was why the voyagers went, the length of time the voyagers were gone, how long they stayed at individual island groups, and what they did when they were there. We can start by looking at the time that they came. It became known as the Enlightenment in Europe, also called the Age of Reason and the Age of Science. And so what changed in Europe and what changed for the voyagers who left was the idea, instead of contextualizing everything in terms of God and the Church, they moved towards looking at observation and what became known as science and the scientific method. So you wanted to know by observing. And so Cook, when he was sent off to the Pacific, went because he was to look at the transit of Venus. And people were positioned all around the Earth from Britain, from the Royal Society, to watch this so that the notes could be compared on what they observed. But it wasn't just astronomy that they went to observe. Botany, biology, zoology, hydrography, geology, a whole number of things were also included. And in addition to observing these things, they had individuals, not all the sciences covered, but people who were trained in those areas. So there were not just sailors on those ships, there were scientists, or proto-scientists, if you will, looking, observing, and making notes, doing drawings, illustrating, and collecting. You also have this idea of categorization of the observable. This was the age of Linnaeus, and this idea that you not only looked at things, but you compared them and you made categorizations of them. So right from the get-go with the journals that are there, you're going to find categorizations and descriptions. In addition, just the sheer volume of the journals is incredible compared to the earlier ones, where you get very brief descriptions, in and out, got water, food, you know, we fought. That's about the end of it. You might get a name. With the explorers who went during the Enlightenment, you have long descriptions. And right from the beginning of the voyages, when they were conceived of, the idea of publishing those journals were there. So the sailors who went, especially the officers, were given directions. as to whether they could keep a journal or whether they should keep a journal or whether they would keep a journal, and what control the captain of the voyages would have, and ultimately the funders back home would have in terms of what happened with those words. So the collecting and categorization and observing aspect was something that was written in right from the word go. And it didn't just extend in terms of plants and animals, but also looking at people and considering the people they met, and kind of a recognition of culture and the idea that people had something that was culture that could be described. It's a kind of proto-anthropology, if you like. You know, the seeds of what would become anthropological sciences 100 and some odd years later were there in terms of what drove people and the kind of descriptions that were being made. Included in this recognition of culture was this collecting of material culture. And again, right from the word go, you have this amassing of material and requesting it, moving with it, trying to get various items and many bits of various items. We find when we've been looking, a group of us have just come back from the United States looking at museum collections there, clubs. I mean, it would bowl you over how many clubs have been collected from various places in the Pacific. We went to the Field Museum, and they had a list of 80 clubs from Tonga alone, from various times. But it was just the sheer number, and people wanted, the explorers wanted these when they went. Also in terms of the collecting is the notion of collecting everyday items, but also very specifically collecting through gifting from chiefly people within Polynesia and elsewhere in the Pacific. And these are not just any items. A lot of the things that we will be looking at that have been put into museum collections today are items that are exquisite. And they were exquisite gifts given by people who had prominence, rank, importance, and power. And they were presenting to people who had come across their shore, foreigners, a demonstration of that power. And they were very specifically giving them those items with, I'm sure, full knowledge of, take them back and show your people who I am. And it always amazes me when we start looking at various things. This happens to be a feather headdress that was in the Museo de America in Madrid. It was found in the drawers after some 200 years, and about 4 years ago was rediscovered and conserved. It's not in very good state. It would have originally been covered completely in parrot feathers, white or red, or a mixture of white and red. And the person who wore that, we know who they are by reading the journals that were done at the time. This comes from the Malaspina expedition that went to Vava'u, the northern group in Tonga, in 1793. We know who gifted it. And that statement of his importance and who he is in that deliberate act of giving that became the deliberate act of collecting by the Spaniards has survived that 200 years. We still know he was wonderful. We still know he was powerful. We can feel that sense of who he was. And I think that's a really important part to me. I love looking at the objects. I love finding out about the context of the Europeans who went. But I'm really interested about what was happening, in particular, in Tonga at that time. Who were these people? What were they doing? Shortly after this particular voyage went to Tonga, a high-ranking chief named Tukuaho, he was Tuikanakapolu, was assassinated. And that plunged Tonga into over 20 years of civil war. And the political landscape changed so much in terms of what happened from the time of this particular individual. He would not have recognized the Tonga of 1826 from the Tonga of 1793. So these objects give us those kind of windows back in to ask questions and to think about the people and what they were doing and who they were. This is an earlier picture of a Tuitonga wearing one of these feather headdresses, which we think are called pala tavake. This comes from an artist who was on the Cook voyage. And yes, we're doing tapa today, but we're also going to have a wee look at pala tavake. And I think what was interesting about it was as a representation of how the European explorers, in this case Cook and his men, encountered the other. how they encountered the people of the Pacific, and the kind of things that they had within them that kind of influenced that encounter. And most definitely this notion of a noble savage, this idea that people were living in a sense closer to nature, in a truer sense of humanity than what was happening in Europe, comes through, and that they were living with a nobility. This changes with time, not because only, but certainly was influenced by the fact that Cook died in Hawaii in the late 1770s. And so again, this notion of perhaps these people were savage and perhaps partly noble, but perhaps not completely noble, influenced a whole group of evangelical Christians within Britain to send out missionaries to change the religion of people and to bring them back to a sense of nobility through Christianity. That also later moved on to racial categorization, you know, dividing up, categorizing the Pacific, whether it was Polynesian, Melanesian, Micronesian, and then that later building into those fantastic 19th century racial categorizations and pyramids of people, judging people against one another in terms of what was perceived as race and the things they made as emblems of civilization. The categorizations were also very gendered. And you find overall, men are often portrayed and described in terms of being warriors. And here's a perfect example of Tuitonga Pau, you know, in that sense of power. And he was a renowned warrior as well. So you see that in terms of, again, how the Europeans constantly categorize and describes. Whereas women, very much seen as nubile females, this sense of an erotic, exotic woman, living closer to nature, living as a noble savage, aware and in touch with her own sexuality and what that means. For the men from Britain and the rest of Europe who went into Polynesia, especially Eastern Polynesia, there was the sense that, you know, that they thought they had found what they thought was heaven on earth. But even the explorers themselves were recording that the women who came out to those ships to meet them, had sexual intercourse with them, had their children, that they also had an agenda. The men didn't know what the agenda was, but they could perceive that this was not just something that was pleasure, which it was too, but there was also a political agenda that these women were obtaining. Without a doubt, a lot of the context, especially for Polynesia, but elsewhere in the Pacific, for Europeans, followed very popular ideas made known by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But he was one of many writers in Europe at the time. He was just the most well-known. This was a general movement that was coming through Europe at the time, and it had more to do with a rejection of what was happening in Europe in terms of industrialization and capitalism and the move to the cities, and people thinking that we needed to get away from that and somehow get back to nature and live closer to nature the way God intended us to live. So this idea of portraying that onto the people of the Pacific who seemed to live that dream was something that not only was interesting to the explorers, but the public back in England just and Europe could just not get enough of it. That's why the journals were immensely popular. That's why things like Tapa books were produced, 100 of them, and probably sold easily. And it would have been a wealthy clientele, I would assume, who would have been buying them and having them in their libraries. Those same people may have also bought other objects that had been collected by these explorers and brought back. So it's a complex kind of a situation that the voyagers came from with their encounter in the Pacific. Anne McClintock, who is a feminist writer in the States, who looks a lot at colonialism, terms this a lot of this, especially the erotic and the exotic, pornotropics. And she said it's the pornography, and it's not just the sexuality, it's the whole conception of it in a European mind that is portraying something on the Pacific. And as she sees it, she calls it a lantern of the mind. And the lantern of the mind is on the European mind. What's going on in that mind to create these fantasies, which then fuel the ambition and ultimately are what is produced and brought back and shown as a result of it. Ooh, I'm going too long. One more, or two more, and we'll go. Ah, can't forget, very quickly, can't forget the politics of exploration and empire. All of the enlightened voyagers who went on these august expeditions of 4 and 5 years had a political agenda. All of the nations that sent them, even if royal society or other, the monarchs or other society scientific organizations were sending them, almost all of them had instructions to claim and start an empire. I'm not going to say more about that now because I'll never stop, but it is an important part to remember in terms of the collection of this, taking those objects across the beaches and then back to the nations, that there was also that sense that we are claiming this as a nation, and I don't think you can go beyond that. Very quickly, just to say this was not just a one-way communication, although I'm talking about it in that sense. This is a first day cover from Tonga that was commemorating Captain Cook coming to Tonga. And once again, you can see my not-so-subtle inclusion of the Palatawake. You know, they certainly remember it. It hasn't been made in Tonga since probably 1800. The one that was found in Madrid is the only existing one that we know exists at all. Cook himself, just again, the politics of collecting, collected three, and he pulled two of them apart to trade with Tahitians for the red feathers, because they wanted those red feathers, so only one of them survived the voyage. And one more, and this is just to tantalize you. This is a piece of Natu that was also presumably collected on the Malaspina expedition, 1793 in Vava'u. We have a pretty good idea, not who made it, unfortunately. They would have been non-chiefly Tongan women in the islands, but the woman or her daughters who presented it to the Spaniards. It is the only intact Natu of this size that, again, has survived and happens to be in the Museo de America. And you can see bits of it. We've yet to get them to fully unroll it for anyone past the time of this photograph, but you can see, you know, the end of it normally if you go and if you ask politely. And it's a wonder to behold. It's a fantastic piece of cloth. And I'm not sure if Shaw had any of pieces this big that he then cut up, but it's certain that he did have larger pieces that became those smaller ones. But when you're looking at that, remember that it's made to impress, and impress it does, and that's the size that would have been a lot of those Natus. Thank you.